This means that with weak string coupling in any of the five formulations, all but the strings will be enormously massive, orders of magnitude heavier than the Planck mass. Because they are so heavy and therefore, from E equals mc squared, require such unimaginably high energy to be produced, brains have only a small effect on much of physics, but not on all, as we shall see in the next chapter. However, when we venture outside the peninsular regions, the higher dimensional brains become lighter and hence increasingly important. And so, the image you should have in mind is the following. In the central region of the M-theory map, we have a theory whose fundamental ingredients are not just strings or membranes, but rather brains of a variety of dimensions, all more or less on equal footing. Currently, we do not have a firm grasp on many essential features of this full theory, but one thing we do know is that as we move from the central region to any of the peninsular regions, only the strings, or membranes curled up to look ever more like strings, are light enough to make contact with physics as we know it, and the four forces through which they interact. The perturbative analyses string theorists have made use of for close to two decades have not been refined enough to discover even the existence of the supermassive extended objects of other dimensions. Strings dominated the analyses, and the theory was given the far from democratic name of string theory. Again, in these regions of the M-theory map, we are justified, for most considerations, in ignoring all but the strings. In essence, this is what we have done so far in this book. We see now, though, that in actuality, the theory is more rich than anyone previously imagined. Does any of this solve the unanswered questions in string theory? Yes and no. We have managed to deepen our understanding by breaking free of certain conclusions that, in retrospect, were a consequence of perturbative approximate analyses rather than true string physics. But the current scope of our non-perturbative tools is quite limited. The discovery of the remarkable web of duality relations affords us far greater insight into string theory, but many issues remain unresolved. At present, for example, we do not know how to go beyond the approximate equations for the value of the string coupling constant, equations that, as we have seen, are too coarse to give us any useful information. Nor do we have any greater insight into why there are precisely three extended spatial dimensions, or how to choose the detailed form for the curled-up dimensions. These questions require more sharply honed, non-perturbative methods than we currently possess. What we do have is a far deeper understanding of the logical structure and theoretical reach of string theory. Prior to the realizations summarized in the M-theory shape we imagined, the strong coupling behavior of each string theory was a black box, a complete mystery. As on maps of old, the realm of strong coupling was uncharted territory, potentially filled with dragons and sea monsters. But now we see that although the journey to strong coupling may take us through unfamiliar regions of M-theory, it ultimately lands us back in the comfortable surrounds of weak coupling, albeit in the dual language of what was once thought to be a different string theory. Duality and M-theory unite the five string theories and they suggest an important conclusion. It may well be that there aren't other surprises, on par with the ones just discussed, that are awaiting our discovery. Once a cartographer can fill in every region on a spherical globe of the Earth, the map is done, and geographical knowledge is complete. That's not to say explorations in Antarctica or on an isolated island in Micronesia are without scientific or cultural merit. It only means that the age of geographic discovery is over. The absence of blank spots on the globe ensures this. A theory map plays a similar role for string theorists. It covers the entire range of theories that can be reached by setting sail from any one of the five string constructions. Although we are far from a full understanding of the terra incognita of M-theory, there are no blank regions on the map. Like the cartographer, the string theorist can now claim with guarded optimism that the spectrum of logically sound theories incorporating the essential discoveries of the past century, special and general relativity, quantum mechanics, gauge theories of the strong, weak, and electromagnetic forces, supersymmetry, extra dimensions of Kaluza and Klein, is fully mapped out. The challenge to the string theorist, or perhaps we should say the M-theorist, is to show that some point on the theory map actually describes our universe. To do this requires finding the full and exact equations whose solution will pick out this elusive point on the map, and then understanding the corresponding physics with sufficient precision to allow comparisons with experiment. As Witten has said, understanding what M-theory really is, the physics it embodies, would transform our understanding of nature at least as radically as occurred in any of the major scientific upheavals of the past. This is the program for unification in the 21st century. Chapter 13. Black Holes. A String M-Theory Perspective. The pre-string theory conflict between general relativity and quantum mechanics was an affront to our visceral sense that the laws of nature should fit together in a seamless, coherent whole. But this antagonism was more than a towering abstract disjunction. The extreme physical conditions that occurred at the moment of the Big Bang and that prevail within black holes cannot be understood without a quantum mechanical formulation of the gravitational force. With the discovery of string theory, we now have a hope of solving these deep mysteries. In this and the next chapter, we describe how far string theorists have gone toward understanding black holes and the origin of the universe. Black holes and elementary particles. At first sight, it's hard to imagine any two things more radically different than black holes and elementary particles. We usually picture black holes as the most gargantuan of heavenly bodies, whereas elementary particles are the most minute specks of matter. But the research of a number of physicists during the late 1960s and early 1970s, including Dimitrios Christodoulou, Werner Israel, Richard Price, Brandon Carter, Roy Kerr, David Robinson, Hawking, and Penrose, showed that black holes and elementary particles are perhaps not as different as one might think. These physicists found increasingly persuasive evidence for what John Wheeler has summarized by the statement, "Black holes have no hair." By this, Wheeler meant that except for a small number of distinguishing features, all black holes appear to be alike. The distinguishing features, one, of course, is the black hole's mass. What are the others? Research has revealed that they are the electric and certain other force charges a black hole can carry, as well as the rate at which it spins. And that's it. Any two black holes with the same mass, force charges, and spin are completely identical. Black holes do not have fancy hairdos, that is, other intrinsic traits that distinguish one from another. This should ring a loud bell. Recall that it is precisely such properties, mass, force charges, and spin, that distinguish one elementary particle from another. The similarity of the defining traits has led a number of physicists over the years to the strange speculation that black holes might actually be gigantic elementary particles. In fact, according to Einstein's theory, there is no minimum mass for a black hole. If we crush a chunk of matter of any mass to a small enough size, a straightforward application of general relativity shows that it will become a black hole. The lighter the mass, the smaller we must crush it. And so, we can imagine a thought experiment in which we start with ever lighter blobs of matter, crush them into ever smaller black holes, and compare the properties of the resulting black holes with the properties of elementary particles. Wheeler's no-hair statement leads us to conclude that for small enough masses, the black holes we form in this manner will look very much like elementary particles. Both will look like tiny bundles characterized completely by their mass, force charges, and spin. But there is a catch. Astrophysical black holes, with masses many times that of the Sun, are so large and heavy that quantum mechanics is largely irrelevant, and only the equations of general relativity need be used to understand their properties. We are here discussing the overall structure of the black hole, not the singular central point of collapse within a black hole, whose tiny size most certainly requires a quantum mechanical description. As we try to make ever less massive black holes, however, there comes a point when they are so light and small that quantum mechanics does come into play. This happens if the total mass of the black hole is about the Planck mass or less. From the point of view of elementary particle physics, the Planck mass is huge, some 10 billion billion times the mass of a proton. From the point of view of black holes, though, the Planck mass, being equal to that of an average grain of dust, is quite tiny. And so physicists who speculated that tiny black holes and elementary particles might be closely related immediately ran up against the incompatibility between general relativity, the theoretical heart of black holes, and quantum mechanics. In the past, the incompatibility stymied all progress in this intriguing direction. Does string theory allow us to go forward? It does. Through a fairly unexpected and sophisticated realization of black holes, string theory provides the first theoretically sound connection between black holes and elementary particles. The road to this connection is a bit circuitous, but it takes us through some of the most interesting developments in string theory, making it a journey well worth taking. It begins with a seemingly unrelated question that string theorists have kicked around since the late 1980s. Mathematicians and physicists have long known that when six spatial dimensions are curled up into a Calabi-Yau shape, there are generally two kinds of spheres that are embedded within the shape's fabric. One kind are the two-dimensional spheres, like the surface of a beach ball, that played a vital role in the space-tearing flop transitions of Chapter 11. The other kind are harder to picture, but they are equally prevalent. They are three-dimensional spheres, like the surfaces of beach balls adorning the sandy ocean shores of a universe with four extended space dimensions. Of course, as we discussed in Chapter 11, an ordinary beach ball in our world is itself a three-dimensional object, but its surface, just like the surface of a garden hose, is two-dimensional. You need only two numbers, latitude and longitude, for instance, to locate any position on its surface. But we are now imagining having one more space dimension, a four-dimensional beach ball whose surface is three-dimensional. As it's pretty close to impossible to picture such a beach ball in your mind's eye, for the most part we will appeal to lower-dimensional analogs that are more easily visualized. But as we shall now see, one aspect of the three-dimensional nature of the spherical surfaces is of prime importance. By studying the equations of string theory, physicists realize that it is possible, and even likely, that as time evolves, these three-dimensional spheres will shrink, collapse, to vanishingly small volume. But what would happen, string theorists asked, if the fabric of space were to collapse in this manner? Will there be some catastrophic effect from this kind of pinching of the spatial fabric? This is much like the question we posed and resolved in Chapter 11, but here we are focusing on collapsing three-dimensional spheres, whereas in Chapter 11 we focused solely on collapsing two-dimensional spheres. As in Chapter 11, since we are envisioning that a piece of a Calabi-Yau shape is shrinking as opposed to the whole Calabi-Yau shape itself, the small radius, large radius identification of Chapter 10 does not apply. Here is the essential qualitative difference arising from the change in dimension. We recall from Chapter 11 that a pivotal realization is that strings, as they move through space, can lasso a two-dimensional sphere. That is, their two-dimensional world sheet can fully surround a two-dimensional sphere. This proves to be just enough protection to keep a collapsing, pinching two-dimensional sphere from causing physical catastrophes. But now we are looking at the other kind of sphere inside a Calabi-Yau space, and it has too many dimensions for it to be surrounded by a moving string. If you have trouble seeing this, it is perfectly okay to think of the analogy obtained by lowering all dimensions by one. You can picture three-dimensional spheres as if they are two-dimensional surfaces of ordinary beach balls, so long as you also picture one-dimensional strings as if they are zero-dimensional point particles. Then, in analogy with the fact that a zero-dimensional point particle cannot lasso anything, let alone a two-dimensional sphere, a one-dimensional string cannot lasso a three-dimensional sphere. Such reasoning led string theorists to speculate that if a three-dimensional sphere inside a Calabi-Yau space were to collapse, something that the approximate equations showed to be a perfectly possible, if not commonplace, evolution in string theory, it might yield a cataclysmic result. In fact, the approximate equations of string theory developed prior to the mid-1990s seemed to indicate that the workings of the universe would grind to a halt if such a collapse were to occur. They indicated that certain of the infinities tamed by string theory would be unleashed by such a pinching of the spatial fabric. For a number of years, string theorists had to live with this disturbing, albeit inconclusive, state of understanding. But in 1995, Andrew Strominger showed that these doomsaying speculations were wrong. Strominger, following earlier groundbreaking work of Witten and Seeberg, made use of the realization that string theory, when analyzed with the newfound precision of the second superstring revolution, is not just a theory of one-dimensional strings. He reasoned as follows. A one-dimensional string, a one-brain in the newer language of the field, can completely surround a one-dimensional piece of space, like a circle. We see that a two-dimensional membrane, a two-brain, can wrap around and completely cover a two-dimensional sphere, much as a piece of plastic wrap can be tightly wrapped around the surface of an orange. Although it's harder to visualize, Strominger followed the pattern and realized that the newly discovered three-dimensional ingredients in string theory, the three brains, can wrap around and completely cover a three-dimensional sphere. Having seen clear to this insight, Strominger then showed, with a simple and standard physics calculation, that the wrapped three-brain provides a tailor-made shield that exactly cancels all of the potentially cataclysmic effects that string theorists had previously feared would occur if a three-dimensional sphere were to collapse. This was a wonderful and important insight, but its full power was not revealed until a short time later. Tearing the fabric of space with conviction. One of the most exciting things about physics is how the state of knowledge can change literally overnight. The morning after Strominger posted his paper on the Electronic Internet Archive, I read it in my office at Cornell after having retrieved it from the World Wide Web. In one stroke, Strominger had made use of the exciting new insights of string theory to resolve one of the thorniest issues surrounding the curling up of extra dimensions into a Calabi-Yau space. But as I pondered his paper, it struck me that he might have worked out only half of the story. In the earlier space-tearing flop transition work described in Chapter 11, we had studied a two-part process in which a two-dimensional sphere pinches down to a point, causing the fabric of space to tear, and then the two-dimensional sphere reinflates in a new way, thereby repairing the tear. In Strominger's paper, he had studied what happens when a three-dimensional sphere pinches down to a point and had shown that the newfound extended objects in string theory ensure that physics continues to be perfectly well-behaved. But that's where his paper stopped. Might it be that there was another half to the story involving, once again, the tearing of space and its subsequent repair through the reinflation of spheres? Dave Morrison was visiting me at Cornell during the spring term of 1995, and that afternoon we got together to discuss Strominger's paper. Within a couple of hours, we had an outline of what the second half of the story might look like. Drawing on some insights from the late 1980s of the mathematicians Herb Clemens of the University of Utah, Robert Friedman of Columbia University, and Miles Reed of the University of Warwick, as applied by Candelas, Green, and Tristan Hubsch, then of the University of Texas at Austin, we realize that when a three-dimensional sphere collapses, it may be possible for the Calabi-Yau space to tear and subsequently repair itself by reinflating the sphere. But there is an important surprise. Whereas the sphere that collapsed had three dimensions, the one that reinflates has only two. It's hard to picture what this looks like, but we can get an idea by focusing on a lower-dimensional analogy. Rather than the hard-to-picture case of a three-dimensional sphere collapsing and being replaced by a two-dimensional sphere, let's imagine a one-dimensional sphere collapsing and being replaced by a zero-dimensional sphere. First of all, what are one- and zero-dimensional spheres? Well, let's reason by analogy. A two-dimensional sphere is the collection of points in three-dimensional space that are the same distance from a chosen center. By following the same idea, a one-dimensional sphere is the collection of points in two-dimensional space, the surface of a page, for example, that are the same distance from a chosen center. This is nothing but a circle. Finally, following the pattern, a zero-dimensional sphere is the collection of points in a one-dimensional space, a line, that are the same distance from a chosen center. This amounts to 2 points, with the radius of the zero-dimensional sphere equal to the distance each point is from their common center. And so, the lower-dimensional analogy alluded to previously involves a circle, a one-dimensional sphere, pinching down, followed by space tearing, and then being replaced by a zero-dimensional sphere, 2 points. We imagine beginning with the surface of a donut, in which a one-dimensional sphere, a circle, is embedded. Now, let's imagine that as time goes by, the embedded circle collapses, causing the fabric of space to pinch. We can repair the pinch by allowing the fabric to momentarily tear, and then replacing the pinched one-dimensional sphere, the collapsed circle, with a zero-dimensional sphere, 2 points, plugging the holes in the upper and lower portions of the shape arising from the tear. The resulting shape looks like a warped banana, which through gentle deformation, non-space tearing, can be reshaped smoothly into the surface of a beach ball. We see, therefore, that when a one-dimensional sphere collapses and is replaced by a zero-dimensional sphere, the topology of the original donut, that is, its fundamental shape, is drastically altered. Although this is a lower-dimensional analogy, it captures the essential features of what Morrison and I foresaw for the second half of Strominger's story. After the collapse of a three-dimensional sphere inside a Calabi-Yau space, it seemed to us that space could tear and subsequently repair itself by growing a two-dimensional sphere, leading to far more drastic changes in topology than Witten and we had found in our earlier work, discussed in Chapter 11. In this way, one Calabi-Yau shape could, in essence, transform itself into a completely different Calabi-Yau shape, much like the donut transforming into the beach ball, while string physics remained perfectly well-behaved. Although a picture was starting to emerge, we knew that there were significant aspects that we would need to work out before we could establish that our second half of the story did not introduce any singularities, that is, pernicious and physically unacceptable consequences. We each went home that evening with the tentative elation that we were sitting on a major new insight. A flurry of email. The next morning I received an email from Strominger asking me for any comments or reactions to his paper. He mentioned that it should tie in somehow with your work with Aspinwall and Morrison, because, as it turned out, he too had been exploring a possible connection to the phenomenon of topology change. I immediately sent him an email describing the rough outline Morrison and I had come up with. When he responded, it was clear that his level of excitement matched what Morrison and I had been writing since the preceding day. During the next few days, a continuous stream of email messages circulated between the three of us as we sought feverishly to put quantitative rigor behind our idea of drastic space-tearing topology change. Slowly but surely, all the details fell into place. By the following Wednesday, a week after Strominger posted his initial insight, we had a draft of a joint paper spelling out the dramatic new transformation of the spatial fabric that can follow the collapse of a three-dimensional sphere. Strominger was scheduled to give a seminar at Harvard the next day, and so left Santa Barbara in the early morning. We had agreed that Morrison and I would continue to fine-tune the paper and then submit it to the electronic archive that evening. By 11:45 p.m., We had checked and rechecked our calculations, and everything seemed to hang together perfectly. And so, we electronically submitted our paper and headed out of the physics building. As Morrison and I walked toward my car, I was going to drive him to the house he had rented for the term, our discussion turned to one of devil's advocacy, in which we imagined the harshest criticisms that someone determined not to accept our results might level. As we drove out of the parking lot and left the campus, we realized that although our arguments were strong and convincing, they were not thoroughly airtight. Neither of us felt that there was any real chance that our work was wrong, but we did recognize that the strength of our claims and the particular wording we had chosen at a few points in the paper might leave the ideas open to rancorous debate, potentially obscuring the importance of the results. We agreed that it might have been better had we written the paper in a somewhat lower key, underplaying the depths of the claims and allowing the physics community to judge the paper on its merits, rather than possibly reacting to the form of its presentation. As we drove on, Morrison reminded me that under the rules of the electronic archive, we could revise our paper until 2 a.m., when it would then be released for public internet access. I immediately turned the car around, and we drove back to the physics building, retrieved our initial submission, and set to work on toning down the prose. Thankfully, it was quite easy to do. A few word changes and critical paragraphs softened the edge of our claims without compromising the technical content. Within an hour, we resubmitted the paper and agreed not to talk about it at all during the drive to Morrison's house. By early the next afternoon, it was evident that the response to our paper was enthusiastic. Among the many email responses was one from Plesser, who gave us one of the highest compliments one physicist can give another by declaring, "I wish that I had thought of that." Notwithstanding our fears the previous night, we had convinced the string theory community that not only can the fabric of space undergo the mild tears discovered earlier, Chapter 11, but that far more drastic rips can occur as well. Returning to black holes and elementary particles. What does this have to do with black holes and elementary particles? A lot. To see this, we must ask ourselves the same question we posed in Chapter 11. What are the observable physical consequences of such tears in the fabric of space? For flop transitions, as we have seen, the surprising answer to this question was that not much happens at all. For conifold transitions, the technical name for the drastic space-tearing transitions we had now found, there is, once again, no physical catastrophe, as there would be in conventional general relativity, but there are more pronounced observable consequences. Two related notions underlie these observable consequences. We will explain each in turn. First, as we have discussed, Strominger's initial breakthrough was his realization that a three-dimensional sphere inside a Calabi-Yau space can collapse without an ensuing disaster, because a three-brain wrapped around it provides a perfect protective shield. But what does such a wrapped brain configuration look like? The answer comes from earlier work of Horowitz and Strominger, which showed that to persons such as ourselves, who are directly cognizant of only the three extended spatial dimensions, the three-brain smeared around the three-dimensional sphere will set up a gravitational field that looks like that of a black hole. This is not obvious, and becomes clear only from a detailed study of the equations governing the brains. A two-dimensional membrane can smear itself around a two-dimensional sphere, which itself is sitting inside a Calabi-Yau space positioned at some location in the extended dimensions. Someone looking through the extended dimensions toward this location will sense the wrapped brain by its mass and the force charges it carries, properties that Horowitz and Strominger had shown would look just like those of a black hole. Moreover, in Strominger's 1995 breakthrough paper, he argued that the mass of a three-brain, the mass of the black hole, that is proportional to the volume of the three-dimensional sphere it wraps. The bigger the volume of the sphere, the bigger the three-brain must be in order to wrap around it, and the more massive it becomes. Similarly, The smaller the volume of the sphere, the smaller the mass of the three-brain that wraps it. As this sphere collapses, then, a three-brain that wraps around the sphere, which is perceived as a black hole, appears to become ever lighter. When the three-dimensional sphere has collapsed to a pinch point, the corresponding black hole, brace yourself, is massless. Although it sounds completely mysterious, what in the world is a massless black hole? We will soon connect this enigma with more familiar string physics. The second ingredient we need to recall is that the number of holes in a Calabi-Yau shape, as discussed in Chapter 9, determines the number of low-energy and hence low-mass vibrational string patterns, the patterns that can possibly account for the three families of fundamental particles, as well as the force carriers. Since the space-tearing conifold transitions change the number of holes, we expect a change in the number of low-mass vibrational patterns. Indeed, when Morrison, Strominger, and I studied this in detail, we found that as a new two-dimensional sphere replaces the pinched three-dimensional sphere in the curled-up Calabi-Yau dimensions, the number of massless string vibrational patterns increases by exactly one. The example of the donut turning into a beach ball would lead you to believe that the number of holes, and thus the number of patterns, decreases, but this proves to be a misleading property of the lower dimensional analogy. To combine these observations, imagine a sequence of snapshots of a Calabi-Yau space in which the size of a particular three-dimensional sphere gets smaller and smaller. The first observation implies that a three-brain wrapping around this three-dimensional sphere, which appears to us as a black hole, will have ever smaller mass until, at the final point of collapse, it will be massless. But as we asked above, what does this mean? The answer became clear to us by invoking the second observation. Our work showed that the new massless pattern of string vibration arising from the space-tearing conifold transition is the microscopic description of a massless particle into which the black hole has transmuted. We concluded that as a Calabi-Yau shape goes through a space-tearing conifold transition, an initially massive black hole becomes ever lighter until it is massless, and then it transmutes into a massless particle, such as a massless photon, which in string theory is nothing but a single string executing a particular vibrational pattern. In this way, for the first time, string theory explicitly establishes a direct, concrete, and quantitatively unassailable connection between black holes and elementary particles. Melting black holes. The connection between black holes and elementary particles which we found is closely akin to something we are all familiar with from day-to-day life, known technically as a phase transition. A simple example of a phase transition is the one we mentioned in the last chapter. Water can exist as a solid, ice, as a liquid, liquid water, and as a gas, steam. These are known as the phases of water, and the transformation from one form to another is called a phase transition. Morrison, Strominger, and I showed that there is a tight mathematical and physical analogy between such phase transitions and the space-tearing conifold transitions from one Calabi-Yau shape to another. Again, just as someone who has never before encountered liquid water or solid ice would not immediately recognize that they are two phases of the same underlying substance, physicists had not realized previously that the kinds of black holes we were studying and elementary particles are actually two phases of the same underlying stringy material. Whereas the surrounding temperature determines the phase in which water will exist, the topological form, the shape, of the extra Calabi-Yau dimensions determines whether certain physical configurations within string theory appear as black holes or elementary particles. That is, in the first phase, the initial Calabi-Yau shape, the analog of the ice phase, say, we find that there are certain black holes present. In the second phase, the second Calabi-Yau shape, the analog of the liquid water phase, these black holes have gone through a phase transition. They have melted, so to speak, into fundamental vibrational string patterns. The tearing of space through conifold transitions takes us from one Calabi-Yau phase to the other. In so doing, we see that black holes and elementary particles, like water and ice, are two sides of the same coin. We see that black holes snugly fit within the framework of string theory.